Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even five times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member, FDIC.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
13 Minutes to the Moon, Season 2.
Nothing made sense in those first few seconds.
Episode 1, available now.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 12th of March, these are our main stories. Shops, restaurants and bars in Italy are being closed for 2 weeks as part of the effort to contain the spread of the coronavirus, now labelled a pandemic by the World Health Organization. The former movie producer Harvey Weinstein has been jailed for 23 years for rape and sexual assault. Also in this podcast, two fraudsters have been jailed in France for impersonating a senior government minister in order to cheat three men out of millions of dollars.
Their pitch was a request to fund secret operations, with reimbursement guaranteed by the Bank of France.
And how women's rugby is helping girls in Pakistan's conservative areas. Italy has taken its fight against the coronavirus outbreak to a new level. In a televised address to the nation on Wednesday night, Giuseppe Conte announced even more stringent measures to contain the spread of the outbreak.
Ora, questo è il momento di compiere un passo in più.
It is now time to take another step. The most important thing is that Italy will always be a single area. But now we need to shut down all commercial activities, apart from food, first aid and pharmacies. So it's not necessary to go out and buy food. We will close bars, pubs, restaurants, hairdressers and beauty salons.
Well, travel across Italy had already been severely restricted, public gatherings banned and residents told to stay at home. James Reynolds is a former Rome correspondent for the BBC. He told us how Italians would be reacting to these new measures.
I think they must be thinking this is the only thing that the government can do. I think it's rather striking that the Prime Minister this time managed to address the nation while they were awake. You might remember on Saturday night when the first partial lockdown came in, he called a news conference at 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't think anyone wanted a repeat of that. The primary concern among a lot of Italians is the stress on the healthcare system. Italy has an older population, and we've seen in the north of the country that the healthcare system is under strain because of that. Indeed, China has now decided to send a number of ventilators towards Italy to help. I've just been looking on the web at a webcam at the Spanish Steps, a place some listeners might have been to as a tourist destination. There's no one there at the moment. A friend of mine in Italy texted me a picture of people queuing up outside a supermarket with a metre difference between them. Italy is perhaps sometimes caricatured as a rather, not necessarily lawless country, but a place where people decide the law is voluntary. It seems that that is very different at the moment.
James Reynolds. Well, earlier, the World Health Organization made this announcement.
WHO has been assessing this outbreak around the clock, and we're deeply concerned both by the alarming levels of spread and severity and by the alarming levels of inaction. We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
Well, that's the head of the organisation, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, and he went on to say that all countries could change the course of the outbreak by taking urgent and aggressive action. But he talked of a lack of resolve from some nations. So what does designating the outbreak as a pandemic mean, and why has that decision been taken now? Catherine Burns is our health correspondent.
In terms of what it means and the way they're going to deal with this, it doesn't make much difference. Really, one thing that was very interesting that was said by the World Health Organization is, we've called every day for countries to take urgent and aggressive action. We've rung the alarm bell loud and clear. And this is another ding on that bell, really. So if you look at the way that this case has spread over the last couple of weeks, the number of cases outside China has increased by 13 times and the number of countries affected has tripled. And this is the World Health Organization saying, everybody around the world, you need to act on this. What they should all be aiming to do is to bring down the peak. We keep talking about the peak. Let's say that we had 50% of our cases in 3 weeks. That's going to cause massive pressure on health services around the world. What they want to do is slow that down, spread it out. And these kind of measures, we can see, actually, there is some evidence now that they do work. So if you look at China and South Korea, the number of cases there is falling. It's down to a trickle, really, in comparison to what it was a while ago. There is a balancing act on all of these things, though, because there is a social cost to it. You know, they only want to do these things when it's absolutely necessary, and timing is really key. They need to go on the science, go on the evidence in each individual country. Also, there's a slight concern that maybe there might be a bit of disruption fatigue if people's lives are disrupted for too long without them feeling the benefits. And there is one thing to watch out for on this. When China and Italy and other countries eventually start to lift these restrictions, there is a concern that maybe the number of cases will surge up again. We don't know yet. We've got to watch and wait.
Just one other error, Catherine, that I think probably is confusing me and will confuse a lot of people, this disparity between figures. We heard in Germany Chancellor Merkel saying that it could affect 60 to 70% of the population there, 50 million people. And then she was then contradicted by a former senior advisor in the health ministry saying, no, it's going to be 50 or 60,000 people. So where does the truth lie?
The really key word then was could. So all governments are going to be looking at reasonable worst case scenarios. You know, there are mathematicians and modellers trying to predict how this will go. And if you want some positive news on this, if you think of the worst affected area in the world, the Hubei province in China, going on the best figures that we've got available, it looks like about 20% were affected. So actually, it's a crystal ball moment. There's a massive range and massive chance for errors here. But all governments are going to be doing the responsible thing, hopefully, right now, planning for that worst case scenario and hoping for the best.
Well, as we heard there from Catherine, the number of cases in South Korea is falling. The country has carried out more tests per head of population than anywhere else in the world. More than 200,000 people have been tested in the last few weeks. And health officials there believe their approach is saving lives. Our Seoul correspondent, Laura Bicker, has gained exclusive access to one of South Korea's labs, where they're still testing thousands of coronavirus swabs every day.
How long does the process take?
The whole process takes about 5 to 6 hours.
Wow, so it's quite quick.
I think it's quite quick.
Dr. Oh Ye-jin is one of a team of scientists who believe South Korea's battle against coronavirus is a race against time. She shows me around her lab, which is now staffed 24 hours a day.
Because of the safety, we are not going to go into this room. This is where the samples are being opened and prepared.
Two men in bright orange protective clothing make their way into the sealed room. They lift a number of testing dishes and get to work. These will be one of around 20,000 coronavirus tests taking place in the country today.
The positive results, the graph comes up the threshold.
South Korea is testing more people for coronavirus per population than anywhere else in the world. A lesson learned from bitter experience with previous infectious diseases.
Like, how long did it take for the CDC and...
About one week.
One week.
Yes. Yeah. One week.
1 week to expand it to Angela.
Yeah, because we are already prepared in advance.
In just a week, nearly 100 labs were set up around the country to test samples from patients. Professor Kwon told me this was Korea's Bali-Bali gene.
We have a Bali-Bali gene.
Bali means fast in Korean. But it is tiring work.
So you're managing to get some sleep?
Scientists believe early testing and early treatment could be why fewer people are dying here. The fatality rate in South Korea is 0.7%, much lower than the 3-4% global average. The testing is free and easily available. We went to a drive-thru clinic in Seoul. With a quick a swab is taken from the back of your throat, then down your nose. You get the results via text in hours. There's also no shortage of kits. They were mass-produced in preparation for this outbreak. The blood of recovered patients is being monitored in the hope of finding antibodies and potentially a vaccine. 28-year-old Lee Eun-bi is one of them and told me he had absolutely no symptoms of coronavirus, just a little cough before he was quarantined.
People around me were very worried. I heard my mom cried every night. It's really important to be still cautious and safe, but I wish people would have less fear of the virus itself. For me at least, the virus felt weaker than a regular cold, but I know those who are older need to be careful.
Meanwhile, life is slowly returning to South Korea's capital city after millions were urged to stay at home. This is exactly what some health officials fear. While they appear to be containing this outbreak for now, they know that with coronavirus, there's no room for complacency.
That report was by Laura Bicker. You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Still to come.
You get winds that are moving at something like 18,000 kilometres an hour. So you can imagine molten iron raining from the sky on this planet.
We go to a hostile planet far, far away. The disgraced film producer Harvey Weinstein has been sentenced to 23 years in prison for rape and sexual assault. A significant fall for a man who'd once been one of Hollywood's most powerful figures. Tarali Wolfe was one of the women who gave evidence in the trial in New York, alleging that Weinstein had raped her.
No one thought Harvey would ever see a courtroom. And even still, no one gave him more than 10 or 12 years. For the first time, I can say I feel a sense of happiness, I guess. Because this isn't a happy circumstance to be that we're all here for. But I feel joyous.
Bystanders applauded the prosecution team as it left the courtroom. Weinstein's lawyer, though, Donna Rotuno, was furious with the length of the sentence.
That sentence that was just handed down by this court was obscene. That number was obnoxious. There are murderers who will get out of court faster than Harvey Weinstein will. I am overcome with anger at that number. I think that number is a cowardly number to give. I think the judge caved, just as I believe the jury caved, and I am not happy.
Well, from outside the court in New York, our correspondent Neda Torfik, tell me about the impact of the sentence on the women.
I think many of the victims were bracing themselves that, you know, despite Harvey Weinstein being convicted of rape, he could possibly still get a slap on the wrist. And so they were very pleasantly surprised that the judge did agree with prosecutors to go on the lengthier side of with 23 years. He was facing up to 29 years. And what the judge said when he read that sentence was that, yes, Harvey Weinstein, this is your first conviction, but it's not your first offense. So he was clearly sending a message there. And the district attorney's office said that this will obviously be very important for other sexual predators and the consequences they'll have to face, and victims who think now about coming forward, feeling like there will be actual accountability for those crimes. So a huge moment for the Me Too movement, a huge moment for the victims. But I have to say, Mimi Haley, one of the victims, in her impact statement to the court, talked about how angry she was that Weinstein wasn't really remorseful in his statement before sentencing. He said he was remorseful, but at the same time, he said he was confused. He thought he had a great relationship with the women, and he was worried that men would not get due process with the Me Too movement. So Weinstein there really not showing remorse for his crimes.
Meanwhile, Ned, very briefly, the court process goes on. There's going to be an appeal from Mr. Weinstein's lawyers.
That's right. You saw how angry his attorney, Donna Rotunno, said she was. She is going forward with an appeal. There'll be a separate team dealing with that. But also, already, prosecutors in Los Angeles are already starting the extradition process to get Harvey Weinstein over to Los Angeles. He faces sexual assault and rape charges there in regards to two women. So he will have to defend himself in yet more allegations. And he's entering that trial already as a convicted rapist.
That was Neda Torfik. Well, Weinstein's case is important, not just because of the severity of his crimes and his high public profile, but also because the allegations helped start the Me Too movement of women speaking out against sexual assault and harassment. Jane Manning is a former US prosecutor of sex crimes. She gave the BBC's Tim Franks her view of the sentence.
It's a very substantial sentence. It is not outside the range of what you might see in a lower profile, but it's on the serious end of that range. It's a strong message.
Are you suggesting that in celebrity cases or people with bigger public profiles, they tend to get lighter sentences?
Well, I think that all eyes were on this case to see if he would get a lighter sentence, but the judge resoundingly did not do that.
I know one can't sort of necessarily say every single case is exactly comparable, but Bill Cosby was a very high-profile public figure, and I think his punishment was something like just between 3 and 10 years, so a lot lighter. Do you think the system has moved on?
I think that the lighter sentence Bill Cosby received simply reflects the fact that he was convicted of a lower level sex crimes.
So we shouldn't necessarily read too much into this in terms of saying that things have moved on.
It absolutely sends an important message. You know, on the one hand, yes, I think that this was one judge's view of one case. But, you know, one pattern that we sometimes see in the justice system is that judges will impose very stiff sentences in cases of stranger rape, but may be a little more lenient in cases of acquaintance rape. And this judge sent a clear signal that he didn't see acquaintance rape, workplace rape, rape within a relationship. The judge didn't see those as any less serious than a stranger rape. So I think this case offers a real teachable moment and a real powerful example for other judges to follow, and it sends a message to other would-be abusers.
And this has been one of the perhaps the most striking aspects has been that these women who were sexually assaulted by Weinstein, in some cases they kept up a relationship of sorts with him afterwards. And and indeed, one of his lawyers said today, or suggested, that that was going to be the basis of their appeal, that in her words, I'll never be able to reconcile all of those circumstances that surround this trial, or the accusations rather, as being what, in her words, what normal, regular rape victims do. And is that where you would take issue with that characterization?
You know, the two victims, while they both maintained contact with him after being raped by Harvey Weinstein, they were two very different kinds of contacts. So Mimi Haley was professionally dependent on her relationship with Harvey Weinstein, and she took job opportunities that he sent her way and communicated with him in a very cordial way, but always in the context of those job relationships. For Jessica Mann, it was different. She was in a personal relationship with him, and there were encounters that were consensual, at least in the legal sense of the word consensual. Two very different circumstances, but both of them not unheard of, either in the world of sexual assault or in the world of domestic violence, right? For Jessica Mann, we really need to look at the world of domestic violence to understand what was happening there.
That was Jane Manning. Let's change tack now and head across the universe to a planet where astronomers believe it rains molten iron. Not only that, but winds blow at thousands of kilometres an hour. Well, from the safety of our studio, I've been speaking to our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos, about it. I asked him what this place was like.
Exotic, I think. Yeah, but you wouldn't want to go on holiday to this place. It's called WASP-76b, strange names, named after the telescope that discovered it a few years ago. But it's one of these things that we call a hot Jupiter. So it's a big gas giant like our Jupiter. But you'll know our Jupiter is a long way from the sun. This particular planet is right close in to its star. Essentially, it's moving around in the atmosphere of the star. So it takes just 43 hours to go around.
that star. And because it's so close in, it is a furnace world. It's a bit like the Earth and the Moon in one sense. You know, when you look at the Moon, you only ever see one side of the Moon. That's what we call tidally locked. Okay, so it only presents that face. This planet does exactly the same thing to its star. So you have this situation where one side of the planet is being utterly roasted. So temperatures up to 2,400 degrees Celsius. Bit cooler on the other side, on the nighttime side. Not an awful lot. But what that sets up is ferocious winds in that temperature gradient between 2,400 on one side and 1,400 on the other side. You get winds that are moving at something like 18,000 kilometres an hour. Now, what scientists have done is they've used an instrument to study the atmosphere of this planet, and they can see iron atoms moving through the atmosphere. And when they look at the what you might call the evening light, so just at that moment when it's about to go dark as the winds go around to the dark side, they see an iron signature, they see the iron atoms. When they look at the morning side, they don't see anything. They don't see the iron atoms. And the assumption is it's condensed out and it's rained out. So you can imagine molten iron raining from the sky on this planet.
So you say they've analysed the atmosphere. How do they do that? It seems extraordinary. What, billions and billions of kilometres away?
Europe has some fabulous telescopes down in Chile called the Very Large Telescope Facility. It's a series of 8-metre class telescopes, and they attach different sorts of instruments to analyse the light that comes down through those telescopes. There's a new one called Espresso. It's a spectrometer. So what that does is it chops the light up into different little bits, and then you can tell the elements from the very bespoke signature, you know, characteristic signature that all elements shine in. They shine in a particular colour. And when you study this star and this planet, then you see the signature of iron. And it's just the way that the Espresso instrument is set up. It looks at what they call the terminator, that moment where darkness becomes light or light becomes darkness. You know, you see it when you see the crescent of the moon. You know, that sort of line between light and dark is called the terminator in astronomical terms. And they're able to look at that and look at the velocities of the iron as it moves across that terminator. And that, for example, gives them the speed of the winds.
That was Jonathan Amos. Senator Bernie Sanders has said he's going to continue his campaign to be the Democratic Party candidate for president. That's despite a disappointing showing in Tuesday's primary elections. In a defiant news conference, Mr. Sanders said he was looking forward to challenging his rival, Joe Biden, in the first televised one-on-one debate on Sunday. But is it all over for Bernie Sanders? Well, Tim Frank spoke to the BBC's Anthony Zerker, who's on the Gulf Coast of Florida.
It definitely is looking that way. I mean, it's a question of simple maths. Joe Biden is building up a significant lead in the delegates to the national convention, and Bernie Sanders would have to win some of these primaries coming up by impressive margins in order to catch up. But states like here in Florida and Ohio and Illinois that come up on Tuesday, Joe Biden's ahead in. So it's hard to look forward and see many states that Bernie Sanders did well in 4 years ago that he could do even better in this time around. It's just math is not on his side.
Was it missteps, do you think, by Sanders? I mean, clearly, you know, Biden had a measure of good fortune in the way that his more moderate rivals folded and then came in behind him. But are there people in the Sanders campaign saying we got it wrong?
Well, you know, I was at a Bernie Sanders a primary watch party last night, and I was talking to one campaign worker who was in Nevada, the last big win that Bernie Sanders had, and he felt like it was all within reach there, that there was a lot of momentum, a lot of interest, and then it all slipped away. And I think they feel that part of it is that the center coalesced faster than their side did, although, to be honest, after last night's results, it looks like Joe Biden has the upper hand, even when it's just the two of them. But I think there are critics who look at Bernie Sanders' campaign, and perhaps people from within the campaign itself, who say maybe Bernie Sanders shouldn't have talked so much about Fidel Castro when pressed. Maybe he should have tried to reach out a little bit more to the middle to try to seem less threatening so that there wouldn't be this kind of reaction against him from some of the moderate voters. But then they will tell me that that's not Bernie Sanders, and he's running the campaign the way he is. And if he had done any of that, he wouldn't have been true to himself, and that was what they loved about him to begin with.
I guess we should also perhaps not get beyond ourselves in this sort of this time of whiplash political reversals, because there is this debate coming up on Sunday, and Joe Biden has proved not necessarily to have the most silken mouth.
No, he's had very up and down debate performances up until now. I think he's been a little bit better as the field narrows. It keeps him engaged and it keeps him on his toes a little more. He would seem like he would get lost in those massive 10-person debates that happened in the middle of last year. But talking to Bernie Sanders supporters over the past day, they're pointing at the debate on Sunday, saying that that could be the turning point. That is essentially their last hope, what they're hanging their hats on. They want to see Bernie Sanders do to Joe Biden what Elizabeth Warren did to Michael Bloomberg back in Las Vegas a couple of weeks ago, which has totally taken him apart and proved to everyone that Sanders is the one to get the nomination. The reality, however, is that Bernie Sanders isn't that kind of candidate. He doesn't go on the attack.
Anthony, just were Sanders' campaign to fold sooner or later, what guarantee that his supporters would rally behind Joe Biden, do you think?
Well, that's the big question. We've seen some polls saying 80%, 80-plus of them would vote for whoever gets the nomination, including Joe Biden. I think right now the nerves are kind of raw, and they're telling me when I talk to them that they don't know if they can support Joe Biden. But the reality is it's going to come down to a choice between Joe Biden and Donald Trump in the fall, if that's the way it shakes out. And their antipathy towards Donald Trump may overwhelm the feelings that they have that Joe Biden took the nomination away from their guy. That may be the motivating factor. The question is whether Joe Biden can reach out and enthuse the younger voters who have supported Bernie Sanders and make sure that they don't just not vote for Donald Trump, but actually show up to the polls and vote for Joe Biden in the fall.
Anthony Zerker. Now, it's been less than 10 years since women's rugby was first introduced into Pakistan. But despite its short history and very little achievement on the ground, the game is helping many women in the country's conservative and less developed areas to grow and shine. The BBC's Shumaila Jaffrey reports from South Punjab.
Proper ek match pace pe jaiye. Crouch. Bind. Set.
On a cold, foggy morning in Pakistan's southern agricultural district of Lodhra, a group of young women in shorts are busy warming up.
Now we will do high knees. Simple. In one line we will do this. You need to lift your knees up really high.
Hasan Shah is standing in the middle with seven players around him in a circle, trying to replicate the coach's action. He set up the local women rugby team in 2013 after talent scouting from women colleges in the district.
Hockey, football, basketball, volleyball and badminton were already being played. But when I showed them rugby, the girls were so confused to see the shape of the ball.
One woman dressed up in green and white shirt and black shorts is particularly energetic. Shazia Shabir is the first ever captain of Pakistan women's rugby team. As a child, she was interested in Taekwondo, but when coach Hasan Shah came to a local college for an orientation session on rugby, Shazia was able to give a trial. The coach liked her game so much that he encouraged her to pursue the game seriously.
I come from a poor family, so when I started the game, it was hard for me to afford the commute. I used to save up my pocket money so that I could attend practice sessions. Gradually, when I became a national level player and played a friendly match with England's women's rugby team, my coach decided to support me.
And it's not just Shazia alone. Most of the rugby players in Pakistan come from lower income families. However, Pakistan's rugby union have helped them to earn a livelihood through the game. Many of the players are now employed by different government departments and play on their behalf. Shazia was initially hired by Pakistan's rugby union to introduce the game to women in South Punjab under the Get Into Rugby program. Coach Shah says that's been a real help.
As a man, I found it hard to reach out to female players in this fairly conservative rural region. I needed a female coach to assist me. So when the Pakistan Rugby Union appointed Shazia, we trained her to coach and were able to reach out to many girls' schools where we were otherwise not allowed. This arrangement helped Shazia financially as well. That's why she's still around playing the game and has been able to continue her studies at the same time.
Shazia is doing master's in physical education on a scholarship that she's getting because of her sport.
It has been a great opportunity to learn. I couldn't even speak properly. When they hired me as a coach, I used to get so nervous, worrying about how to communicate with the girls. But they trained and encouraged me. Plus, if you're good at the game, your tuition fee gets waived.
Women in sport are still not widely accepted in Pakistan. And particularly in rugby, which is considered a manly game. Shazia was the first woman in her family who was even allowed to be a sportswoman. Her parents were supportive, but her extended family were against it. However, Shazia's achievements have forced many of her relatives to change their minds, thus allowing the women in her family to pursue their dreams.
That report was by Shumaila Jaffrey. Two fraudsters have been jailed in France for impersonating a government minister in order to cheat three men out of some $62 million. Prosecutors said the victims included the spiritual leader of the Ismaili Muslims, the Aga Khan. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
It was a scam that failed around 150 times, but it took only three people to fall for it to make it very lucrative. One con man would pass himself off as Jean-Yves Le Drian, the defence minister at the time. They set up video conferences, seemingly from the ministry's basement bunker. Their pitch was a request to fund secret operations, with reimbursement guaranteed by the Bank of France. One victim was a Turkish businessman who paid a bogus ransom, reportedly $47 million. The ringleader, Gilbert Chicly, got 11 years and a fine of more than $2 million.
That was our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address, as usual, is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Suddenly there was a big bang.
An explosion in the depths of space.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
Three astronauts in grave danger.
It looks grim. Yes, it does.
As space exploration becomes a life or death situation.
We're not going to the moon anymore. We're going to just be damn lucky to get home.
13 Minutes to the Moon returns with a story of a dramatic rescue mission.
You're 200,000 miles out. You're in a spacecraft that's dying.
The real story of Apollo 13.
I literally got on my knees and prayed.
13 Minutes to the Moon, Season 2.
We don't have much time.
From the BBC World Service.
One whole side of that spacecraft missing.
Search for 13 Minutes to the Moon wherever you get your podcasts.
That's the end right there.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Just imagine, five times more savings toward that overdue home addition, maybe even an addition on that addition. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.